It was with that mindset that I entered the 2004 U.S. Senate race. For the duration of the campaign, I did my best to say what I thought, keep it clean, and focus on substance. When I won the Democratic primary and then the general election, both by sizable margins, it was tempting to believe that I had proven my point. No wonder, then, that upon my arrival in Washington that January, I felt like the rookie who shows up after the game, his uniform spotless, eager to play, even as his mud-splattered teammates tend to their wounds. While I had been busy with interviews and photo shoots full of high-minded ideas about the need for less partisanship and acrimony, Democrats had been beaten across the board. The presidency, Senate seats, House seats. My new Democratic colleagues could not have been more welcoming toward me. One of our few bright spots, they would call my victory. In the corridors, though, or during a lull in the action on the floor, they'd pull me aside and remind me of what typical Senate campaigns had come to look like. They told me about their fallen leader, Tom Daschle of South Dakota, who had seen more than $10 million worth of negative ads rain down on his head, full-page newspaper ads and television spots informing his neighbors day after day that he supported baby killing and men in wedding gowns, a few even suggesting that he'd treated his first wife badly despite the fact that she had traveled to South Dakota to help him get reelected. They recalled Max Cleland, the former Georgia incumbent, a triple amputee war veteran who had lost his seat in the previous cycle after being accused of insufficient patriotism, of aiding and abetting Osama bin Laden. 2 days after the election, President Bush appeared before cameras and declared that he had political capital to spare, and he intended to use it. That same day, conservative activist Grover Norquist, unconstrained by the decorum of public office, observed, in connection with the Democrat situation, that, quote, "Any farmer will tell you that certain animals run around and are unpleasant, but when they've been fixed, then they are happy and sedate." 2 days after my swearing-in, Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones, out of Cleveland, stood up in the House of Representatives to challenge the certification of Ohio electors, citing the litany of voting irregularities that had taken place in the state on Election Day. Rank-and-file Republicans scowled, sore losers, I could hear a few mutter, but Speaker Hastert and Majority Leader DeLay sat stone-faced from the heights of the dais, placid in the knowledge that they had both the votes and the gavel. Senator Barbara Boxer of California agreed to sign the challenge, and when we returned to the Senate, I found myself casting my first vote, along with 73 of the 74 others voting that day, to install George W. Bush for a second term as President of the United States. I would get my first big batch of phone calls and negative mail after this vote. I called back some of my disgruntled Democratic supporters, assuring them that yes, I was familiar with the problems in Ohio, and yes, I thought an investigation was in order, but yes, I still believed George Bush had won the election, and no, as far as I could tell, I didn't think I'd either sold out or been co-opted after a mere 2 days on the job. My wife will tell you that by nature I'm not somebody who gets real worked up about things. When I see Ann Coulter or Sean Hannity baying across the television screen, I find it hard to take them seriously. I assume that they must be saying what they do primarily to make money, although I do wonder who would spend their precious evenings with such sourpusses. When Democrats rush up to me at events and insist that we live in the worst of political times, that a creeping fascism is closing its grip around our throats, I may mention the internment of Japanese Americans under FDR, the alien and sedition laws under Adams, or 100 years of lynching under several dozen administrations as having been possibly worse, and suggest we all take a deep breath. When people at dinner parties ask me how I can possibly operate in the current political environment, with all the negative campaigning and personal attacks, I may mention Nelson Mandela, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, or some guy in a Chinese or Egyptian prison somewhere. In truth, being called names is not such a bad deal. Still, I am not immune to distress. And like most Americans, I find it hard to shake the feeling these days that our democracy has gone seriously awry. It's not simply that a gap exists between our professed ideals as a nation and the reality we witness every day. In one form or another, that gap has existed since America's birth. Wars have been fought, laws passed, systems reformed, unions organized, and protests staged to bring promise and practice into closer alignment. No, what's troubling is the gap between the magnitude of our challenges and the smallness of our politics. The ease with which we are distracted by the petty and trivial. Our chronic avoidance of tough decisions. Our seeming inability to build a working consensus to tackle any big problem. We know that global competition, not to mention any genuine commitment to the values of equal opportunity and upward mobility, requires us to revamp our education system from top to bottom, replenish our teaching corps, buckle down on math and science instruction, and rescue inner-city kids from illiteracy. And yet our debate on education seems stuck between those who want to dismantle the public school system and those who would defend an indefensible status quo, between those who say money makes no difference in education and those who want more money without any demonstration that it will be put to good use. We know that our healthcare system is broken, wildly expensive, terribly inefficient, and poorly adapted to an economy no longer built on lifetime employment. A system that exposes hardworking Americans to chronic insecurity and possible destitution. We know that the battle against terrorism is at once an armed struggle and a contest of ideas, that our long-term security depends on both judicious projection of military power and increased cooperation with other nations, and that addressing the problems of global poverty and failed states is vital to our nation's interests, rather than just a matter of charity. But follow most of our foreign policy debates, and you might believe that we have only two choices, belligerence or isolationism. We think of faith as a source of comfort and understanding, but find our expressions of faith sowing division. We believe ourselves to be a tolerant people, even as racial, religious, and cultural tensions roil the landscape. And instead of resolving these tensions or mediating these conflicts, our politics fans them, exploits them, and drives us further apart. Privately, those of us in government will acknowledge this gap between the politics we have and the politics we need. Certainly, Democrats aren't happy with the current situation, since for the moment at least, they're on the losing side, dominated by Republicans who, thanks to winner-take-all elections, control every branch of government and feel no need to compromise. Thoughtful Republicans shouldn't be too sanguine, though, for if the Democrats have had trouble winning, it appears that the Republicans, having won elections on the basis of pledges that often defy reality, tax cuts without service cuts, privatization of Social Security with no change in benefits, war without sacrifice, cannot govern. And yet publicly, it's difficult to find much soul-searching or introspection on either side of the divide, or even the slightest admission of responsibility for the gridlock. What we hear instead, not only in campaigns, but in editorial pages, on bookstands, or in the ever-expanding blog universe, are deflections of criticism and assignments of blame. Of course, there is another story to be told, by the millions of Americans who are going about their business every day. They're on the job or looking for work, starting businesses, helping their kids with their homework, and struggling with high gas bills, insufficient health insurance, and a pension that some bankruptcy court somewhere has rendered unenforceable. They are by turns hopeful and frightened about the future. Their lives are full of contradictions and ambiguities. And because politics seems to speak so little to what they're going through, because they understand that politics today is a business and not a mission, and what passes for debate is little more than spectacle, they turn inward, away from the noise and rage and endless chatter. A government that truly represents these Americans, that truly serves these Americans, will require a different kind of politics. That politics will need to reflect our lives as they are actually lived. It won't be prepackaged, ready to pull off the shelf. It will have to be constructed from the best of our traditions, and we'll have to account for the darker aspects of our past. We will need to understand just how we got to this place, this land of warring factions and tribal hatreds. And we'll need to remind ourselves, despite all our differences, just how much we share. Common hopes, common dreams, a bond that will not break. There's no denying that American politics in the post-World War II years was far less ideological, and the meaning of party affiliation far more amorphous than it is today. The Democratic coalition that controlled Congress through most of those years was an amalgam of Northern liberals like Hubert Humphrey, conservative Democrats like Jim Eastland, and whatever loyalists the big city machines cared to elevate. What held this coalition together was the economic populism of the New Deal, a vision of fair wages and benefits, patronage and public works, and an ever-expanding standard of living. Throughout the 50s and early 60s, the GOP, too, tolerated all sorts of philosophical fissures. Between the Western libertarianism of Barry Goldwater and the Eastern paternalism of Nelson Rockefeller. Between those who recalled the republicanism of Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt with its embrace of federal activism, and those who followed the conservatism of Edmund Burke with its preference of tradition to social experimentation. It was the 60s that upended these political alignments for reasons and in ways that have been well chronicled. First, the civil rights movement arrived, a movement that even in its early, halcyon days, fundamentally challenged the existing social structure and forced Americans to choose sides. Then came the social protests against the Vietnam War, and the suggestion that America was not always right, our actions not always justified, that a new generation would not pay any price or bear any burden that its elders might dictate. And then, with the walls of the status quo breached, every form of outsider came streaming through the gates. Feminists, Hispanics, hippies, Panthers, welfare moms, gays, all asserting their rights, all insisting on recognition, all demanding a seat at the table and a piece of the pie. I've always felt a curious relationship to the 60s. In a sense, I'm a pure product of that era. As the child of a mixed marriage, my life would not have been possible, my opportunities entirely foreclosed, without the social upheavals that were then taking place. But I was too young at the time to fully grasp the nature of those changes, too removed, living as I did in Hawaii and Indonesia, to see the fallout on America's psyche. Much of what I absorbed from the 60s was filtered through my mother, who to the end of her life would proudly proclaim herself an unreconstructed liberal. The civil rights movement in particular inspired her reverence. Whenever the opportunity presented itself, she would drill into me the values that she saw there. Tolerance, equality, standing up for the disadvantaged. It was only as I got older then, during the 70s, that I came to appreciate the degree to which, for those who had experienced more directly some of the 60s seminal events, things must have seemed to be spinning out of control. Partly I understood this through the grumblings of my maternal grandparents, longtime Democrats who would admit that they'd voted for Nixon in 1968, an act of betrayal that my mother would never let them live down. Mainly, my understanding of the 60s came as a result of my own investigations, as my adolescent rebellion sought justification in the political and cultural changes that by then had already begun to ebb. In my teens, I became fascinated with the Dionysian, up-for-grabs quality of the era, and through books, film, and music, I soaked in a vision of the 60s very different from the one my mother talked about. Images of Huey Newton, the 68 Convention, the Saigon Airlift, and the Stones at Altamont. If I had no immediate reasons to pursue revolution, I decided nevertheless that in style and in attitude, I too could be a rebel, unconstrained by the received wisdom of the over-30s crowd. Eventually, my rejection of authority spilled into self-indulgence and self-destructiveness, and by the time I enrolled in college, I'd begun to see how any challenge to convention harbored within it the possibility of its own excesses and its own orthodoxy. I started to re-examine my assumptions and recall the values that my mother and grandparents had taught me. In this slow, fitful process of sorting out what I believed, I began silently registering the point in dorm room conversations when my college friends and I stopped thinking and slipped into cant, the point at which the denunciations of capitalism or American imperialism came too easily, and the freedom from the constraints of monogamy or religion were proclaimed without fully understanding the value of such constraints, and the role of victim was too readily embraced as a means of shedding responsibility, or asserting entitlement, or claiming moral superiority over those not so victimized. All of which may explain why, as disturbed as I might have been by Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, as unconvinced as I might have been by his John Wayne, Father Knows Best pose, his policy by anecdote, and his gratuitous assaults on the poor, I understood his appeal. It was the same appeal that the military bases back in Hawaii had always held for me as a young boy, with their tidy streets and well-oiled machinery, and the crisp uniforms and crisper salutes. It was related to the pleasure I still get from watching a well-played baseball game, or my wife gets from watching reruns of The Dick Van Dyke Show. Reagan spoke to America's longing for order, our need to believe that we are not simply subject to blind, impersonal forces, but can shape our individual and collective destinies, so long as we rediscover the traditional virtues of hard work, patriotism, personal responsibility, optimism, and faith. That Reagan's message found such a receptive audience spoke not only to his skills as a communicator, it also spoke to the failures of liberal government, during a period of economic stagnation, to give middle-class voters any sense that it was fighting for them. For the fact was that government at every level had become too cavalier about spending taxpayer money. Too often, bureaucracies were oblivious to the cost of their mandates. A lot of liberal rhetoric did seem to value rights and entitlements over duties and responsibilities. Reagan may have exaggerated the sins of the welfare state, and certainly liberals were right to complain that his domestic policies tilted heavily towards economic elites, with corporate raiders making tidy profits throughout the 80s, while unions were busted and the incomes for the average working stiff flatlined. Nevertheless, by promising to side with those who worked hard, obeyed the law, cared for their families, and loved their country, Reagan offered Americans a sense of common purpose that liberals no longer could muster. And the more his critics carped, the more those critics played into the role he'd written for them, a band of out-of-touch, tax and spend, blame America first, politically correct elites. What I find remarkable is not that the political formula developed by Reagan worked at the time, but just how durable the narrative that he helped promote has proven to be. Despite a 40-year remove, the tumult of the 60s and the subsequent backlash continues to drive our political discourse. Partly it underscores how deeply felt the conflicts of the 60s must have been for the men and women who came of age at that time, and the degree to which the arguments of the era were understood not simply as political disputes, but as individual choices that defined personal identity and moral standing. I suppose it also highlights the fact that the flashpoint issues of the 60s were never fully resolved. And maybe it just has to do with the sheer size of the boomer generation, a demographic force that exerts the same gravitational pull in politics that it exerts on everything else, from the market for Viagra to the number of cup holders automakers put in their cars. Whatever the explanation, after Reagan, the lines between Republican and Democrat, liberal and conservative, would be drawn in more sharply ideological terms. This was true, of course, for the hot-button issues of affirmative action, crime, welfare, abortion, and school prayer, all of which were extensions of earlier battles. But it was also now true for every other issue, large or small, domestic or foreign, all of which were reduced to a menu of either-or, for or against, soundbite-ready choices. No longer was economic policy a matter of weighing trade-offs between competing goals of productivity and distributional justice, of growing the pie and slicing the pie. You were either for tax cuts or for tax hikes, small government or big government. No longer was environmental policy a matter of balancing sound stewardship of our natural resources with the demands of a modern economy. You either supported unchecked development, drilling, strip mining, and the like, or you supported stifling bureaucracy and red tape that choked off growth. In politics, if not in policy, simplicity was a virtue. For a younger generation of conservative operatives that would soon rise to power, for Newt Gingrich and Karl Rove and Grover Norquist and Ralph Reed, the fiery rhetoric was more than a matter of campaign strategy. They were true believers who meant what they said, whether it was no new taxes or we are a Christian nation. In fact, with their rigid doctrines, slash-and-burn style, an exaggerated sense of having been aggrieved, this new conservative leadership was eerily reminiscent of some of the New Left's leaders during the 60s. As with their left-wing counterparts, this new vanguard of the right viewed politics as a contest not between competing policy visions, but between good and evil. You had to choose sides. It was Bill Clinton's singular contribution that he tried to transcend this ideological deadlock, recognizing not only that what had come to be meant by the labels of conservative or liberal played to Republican advantage, but that the categories were inadequate to address the problems we faced. In the first 2 years of his presidency, he would be forced to abandon some core elements of his platform, universal health care, aggressive investment in education and training, that might have more decisively reversed the long-term trends that were undermining the position of working families in the new economy. Still, he instinctively understood the falseness of the choices being presented to the American people. He saw that government spending and regulation could, if properly designed, serve as vital ingredients and not inhibitors to economic growth, and how markets and fiscal discipline could help promote social justice. He recognized that not only societal responsibility, but personal responsibility was needed to combat poverty. In his platform, if not always in his day-to-day politics, Clinton's third way went beyond splitting the difference. It tapped into the pragmatic, non-ideological attitude of the majority of Americans. Indeed, by the end of his presidency, Clinton's policies, recognizably progressive if modest in their goals, enjoyed broad public support. Politically, he had wrung out of the Democratic Party some of the excesses that had kept it from winning elections. That he failed, despite a booming economy, to translate popular policies into anything resembling a governing coalition said something about the demographic difficulties Democrats were facing, in particular the shift in population growth to an increasingly solid Republican South, and the structural advantages the Republicans enjoyed in the Senate. But that failure also testified to the skill with which Gingrich, Rove, Norquist, and the like were able to consolidate and institutionalize the conservative movement. They tapped the unlimited resources of corporate sponsors and wealthy donors to create a network of think tanks and media outlets. They brought state-of-the-art technology to the task of mobilizing their base and centralized power in the House of Representatives in order to enhance party discipline. And they understood the threat Clinton posed to their vision of a long-term conservative majority, which helps explain the vehemence with which they went after him. With enough repetition, a looseness with the facts, and the ultimately undeniable evidence of the president's own personal lapses, Clinton could be made to embody the very traits of 60s liberalism that had helped spur the conservative movement in the first place. Clinton may have fought that movement to a draw, but the movement would come out stronger for it, and in George W. Bush's first term, that movement would take over the United States government.